today on Against the Grain, what has the dramatic rise of the financial sector done to the power and profits of lenders and institutional investors? In his new book, Ivan Asher examines the forms of domination and exploitation that have accompanied the extraordinary expansion of credit and of financial markets. I'm C.S. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee professor joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Credit cards, mortgages, and loans of other kinds are often seen as conveniences. We buy things on credit, we stretch out our payments, we keep the cash in our pockets for an extra month or year. But why, asks Ivan Asher in a new book, why are institutions so eager to lend us money? What's the source of their extraordinary wealth and power? In his book, Portfolio Society, Asher draws interesting and sobering parallels between capitalist exploitation in the era of factory production and exploitation in this age of finance. He shows how and why lending has changed, what the packaging of mortgage-backed and other securities has done to and for financial institutions, and how a kind of violence, although different than the violence inflicted on workers in Karl Marx's time, is being perpetrated upon people desperate for the credit they need to make ends meet. Ivan Asher is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. His new book is Portfolio Society on the Capitalist Mode of Prediction. When Ivan Asher joined me in studio, I asked him what Marx observed about the sale of products and the labor that made those products.
Well, as you say, Marx looks at things as they are produced, but also as they're exchanged. And those are basically what he calls commodities, or at least in the English, it's commodities or merchandise. And he asks after the nature of that exchange and what it means to exchange commodities one for the other. And he shares in the belief, or at least he seems to share in the belief of the age, that the value of these commodities comes from the labor required to produce them. So really what's behind these things, or what creates these things, is human labor. One of the things that he does in this, I think, quite remarkable, is he asks, how is it possible that the exchange of things or commodities, which are exchanged at their value, and their value is dependent on the amount of labor required to produce them, how is it that that exchange of commodities generates wealth, or wealth for some people, and really misery for the others? And so what he does is he confronts us with something of a puzzle, a bit of an artificial puzzle, but a puzzle nonetheless, where, as I said, things are exchanged at their value, and yet out of this comes money. And so he follows this character that he calls Mr. Moneybags to the market, and he says Moneybags is lucky because he finds one commodity among all others that's able to produce more value than it has, really, or produce value as you use it. And that commodity is what he calls labor power. It's the ability to produce things.
So in other words, he saw Karl Marx and Moneybags, this capitalist character he created, they see labor as a commodity, as something to be sold and bought on the market.
Exactly. So one way to think about it is what he finds on the market really are individuals who need to live, and what they have to offer is simply their capacity to labor, and they have really nothing else to offer. So he's able to pay them in exchange for their labor, or rather their labor power, and he pays them a wage that is really, technically speaking, fair, because it's the exact amount that will allow them to reproduce their labor power.
In other words, to sustain themselves so that they can go to work each day.
Exactly. So, you know, one way to think about it is if you're working at McDonald's, say, flipping burgers, you've entered into a contract with McDonald's, and the agreement is that in exchange for your labor power, you'll be paid a wage with which then to buy enough food to reproduce yourself. So if you're flipping, say, 100 burgers over the course of a day, you'll get paid enough burgers that you can then show up the next day and flip another 100 burgers. Now, of course, because you flipped 100 burgers and you only need, you know, so many burgers every day, the remaining burgers then McDonald's can sell and thereby create or generate profit that you've really created yourself by your labor.
And this is what's called surplus value, according to Marx, right?
That's right. That's surplus value, which is created by the worker, appropriated by the capitalist when they sell the product.
So the capitalist gets more value out of the worker than he or she pays the worker.
Yes. And again, there's the ruse, if you will, is that this law of exchange is perfectly fair because the capitalist is paying the worker the wage that is required to reproduce the labor power. And yet at the end of the day, somehow miraculously, because the capitalist owns the means of production, as Marx calls them, is able to make more money than was put in initially, in a sense.
And because this term is important to the time we spend together, what are the means of production?
Well, the means of production, in a simple sense, is really just, if you think of the factory and the machines, those are the things that the worker will then mix their labor power in, and whoever has control of those means of production effectively commands the labor of the laborer.
Okay, so if we see surplus value as the way in which the capitalist, the factory owner, the business owner, makes profits for himself or herself, is factory production of the kind that Marx focused on, and he did focus on other things, is that the primary source of profits in today's advanced capitalist nations as you see it?
By and large, I would say no, which is not to say, of course, that people aren't working and making things and the capitalist isn't deriving a profit from that. But increasingly, at least in the countries you describe, profit comes from the financial sector. And it's not just a matter of where does profit come from, but to what extent is industrial capital really what shapes social relations under capital? I think to a large extent, it's financial capitalism or derivative markets and so forth that are the defining feature of contemporary capitalism. So there's an analogous process at work, but I think if we're going to extend Marx's critique of political economy, we have to revisit and maybe update his categories.
What activities fall within the category of finance?
That's a good question to which I don't have a very good answer. Finance means different things at different times. The way I see it, in the last 40 years or so, we've had not just the rise of finance, but the rise of derivative finance or financial markets. So finance, of course, is a way of you might invest in a company, or a capitalist might look for funds on financial markets, but it's also increasingly a speculative realm, and it's that speculative activity that I think is so detrimental to contemporary capitalist relations.
So investment falls within the category of finance. What about credit? And if we talk about credit, what are the different kinds of things that fall within that?
Well, one way to think about, you're right that credit is really at the heart of finance. And when I say that finance is increasingly shaping our relations, if you think of credit cards, say, that increasingly mediate our relations of exchange, whenever you use a credit card to purchase something, you're engaging in the world of finance because you're not actually, say, buying your coffee with your money. Your bank is lending you money, buying the coffee in your stead, and then you have to pay that credit card bill at the end of the day. So credit has kind of become, it was always there, but it's become increasingly part of that market exchange. And it's in the backdrop, of course, also of production, which is to say, capitalists need to borrow money on financial markets in order to produce the goods that they want to sell and so forth. So finance, it's always been there. It's just increasingly at the surface of our existence.
And so then what has changed about the willingness of lenders to lend money to people and the willingness or maybe the inclination of people to borrow money from lenders?
Well, there are different ways of telling that story, but certainly one thing that I think is remarkable is the extent to which, at least in the U.S., many of us are borrowing money in ways that perhaps we weren't able to before. In many ways, that's something to be celebrated, I suppose. If you think of the movie It's a Wonderful Life, you have a depiction of a certain kind of banker played by Jimmy Stewart. George Bailey is the character, and this is somebody who's willing to lend money to people whom he knows to be trustworthy, or he thinks to be trustworthy. And he can only do this to so many people because, really, you can only lend to people that you know personally. One of the things that happens over the last 50 years or so is that it becomes possible to lend to people that you don't know, partly because a record has been kept of people's borrowing and payment habits such that it becomes possible to make determinations of one's creditworthiness without necessarily knowing that person. So it's to be celebrated in the sense that certain prejudices seem to disappear. So it used to be that women weren't able to borrow, or African Americans weren't able to borrow. That's no longer the case. At the same time, there are, of course, pernicious dimensions behind that. As more and more lenders are willing and able to lend to more people, it also means that more and more people are getting caught in the web of debt.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ivan Asher joins me. He teaches political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're talking about his book, Portfolio Society on the Capitalist Mode of Prediction, published by Zone Books. So what specifically has changed in terms of what a lender asks of a prospective borrower before the lender comes up with the money to lend? What's changed about that? What level of detail has become required before a lender says yes to a loan?
Well, remarkably, I don't know what your experience is, but it's, you know, you don't get asked that many questions if you ask for a loan. But that isn't because any data hasn't been recorded. So if you take the stylized example I just gave of Jimmy Stewart, this is somebody who knew about your church-going habits and knew something about your marital status and so forth. And so the sense was that they could basically peer into your soul, make a determination about your character, and determine whether to lend you money or not. Over the years, various things happen, and this is not all deliberate, but take an example. Sears and Roebuck had catalogs for, you know, selling things by mail, and so they would ask people questions in questionnaires. And this was one of the first instances where data were being collected on people's spending and payment habits that would then become available for scrutiny later, such that by the time credit cards come into play, they're able to, again, make judgments that have less to do with somebody's character than with probabilistic assessments of whether they're going to default or make good on their promises. So these days we have, as you know, the credit score is a determinant factor in whether you get credit or not, or the rate at which you get credit. And sadly, I couldn't tell you the detail of what goes into a credit score, but suffice it to say, it has to do with comparisons between different people. So if you live in this neighborhood or that neighborhood, you're going to benefit or suffer from the attributes or the past history of your neighbors.
So presumably, if people are judging, lenders are judging, and they always have, of course, but you're saying now in different ways, they are judging the trustworthiness, the creditworthiness of a borrower. They're also going to see whether this person has defaulted on a loan, on any loan maybe, in the past. What's happened to that kind of information, who it's given to, what it's given to, and what's done with it?
It's a complicated story in the sense that there are many institutions involved here. So in the story that Marx told, there was this figure, Moneybags. The way I think of it, we can still speak of Moneybags as a kind of archetypal capitalist. But the truth of the matter is there are banks, there are credit rating agencies, there are all kinds of institutions involved. And it's hard to exactly discern who shares what with whom or what are the key players. But overall, I would say that this information that's gathered, called together, is a bit analogous to what the capitalist in Marx's day was able to do, which is to say, if you had control of what we call the means of production, you were able to put this labor to work for you. And those who now have control over what I call the means of prediction have a similar kind of leverage, if you will. And by means of prediction, in a sense, I'm just being clever by half, but it's the data, the algorithms, all this information that has been culled over the years and that allows money bags to make these determinations over people's credit worthiness.
And it's a way of, broadly speaking, it's a way of managing the risk, of the lender managing the risk he sees in parting with this kind of money, or perhaps a lot of money.
That's right. And what's remarkable to my mind is that in this world of risk, we have something analogous to what Marx saw in the world of labor. What I mean is this. In the story we were just discussing earlier, where the worker gets paid a wage with which to reproduce their labor power, if you think of our credit relations, it's not so dissimilar. So if I apply for a loan, I will get a loan at a certain interest rate, and that interest rate reflects my creditworthiness or is dependent on my creditworthiness. So if I've been good in the past or if my neighbors have been good in the past, I can expect to get a pretty decent interest rate. And that's, in a sense, a very fair exchange. So I get the credit I deserve, if you will. It's something that will allow me to reproduce my own creditworthiness, nothing more, nothing less. But what the capitalist or the money lender is able to do is, because they're lending to a great number of people, some of whom are riskier than others, the capitalists find themselves with a diversified portfolio. And because that portfolio is diversified, they themselves find themselves in a position to then borrow on financial markets at an interest rate that is more advantageous than the one to which they that I was able to get.
Oh, I see. So the lenders, they need money. They need to borrow money in order to lend it to other people. So what you're saying is what they're doing in relation to their debtors helps them with establish what? Their own credibility in the view of those who might actually lend money to him?
That's right. It's one way of describing the process known as securitization, which many of us, I think, discovered in the context of the financial crisis. So if you get a mortgage from a bank, that mortgage actually then is passed on to others. So the lender basically doesn't hold on to the IOU. They sell those IOUs to others, but they're able to sell them on terms that are better for them than the terms that you and I got on our mortgage.
And we were talking at the beginning of this hour about the source of profits for the classic factory owner that Marx focused a lot on. So where is the focus of, or the source of profits for these institutions, for these lenders?
Well, that question will get different answers from different people. One way to think of it is, at the end of the day, the source of profit, or certainly the source of value, is still labor. The question is, what are the terms under which that labor is exploited or made profitable? It's not that labor is displaced by credit, but somehow the terms under which that profit is made do change. And to the extent that profit accrues to the financial sector rather than, say, the industrial sector, it would seem that it's in this appropriation of people's probability or risk, that's where the profit is made.
Let's talk about credit cards for a moment in more detail. So when did the credit card appear, and what did it mean for how and where credit was negotiated between the lender and the borrower?
So the credit card has an interesting history. I think the first significant card was the Diners Club, if I'm not mistaken. I think that goes back to the middle of the 20th century, around 1949. And what the credit card does, as you put it, is it changes the terms and the place where that credit relationship is negotiated. So instead of going to your local banker and applying for credit, you go to, say, Visa. And so they are the ones who are now the key players in the allocation of credit. And it doesn't happen, as I say, even physically or geographically at the same level, but also they are able to compare the behavior of people in different places and make these determinations in what are effectively much less personal terms.
I'm speaking with Ivan Asher. He's assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and he teaches modern political and social theory with an emphasis on critiques of contemporary capitalism. His new book is Portfolio Society on the Capitalist Mode of Prediction. And we have a link on againstthegrain.org, both to Portfolio Society as well as to Ivan's faculty page at the University of Wisconsin. And of course, I guess we should say that credit card companies thrive on people who don't pay off their debts every month.
That's right. The ideal borrower, I think, from the standpoint of the money lender, is somebody who pays regularly but doesn't pay off their debts every month. People like that are called revolvers. They're reliable because they're not going to default on their debt, but they're reliably late. And so you can legitimately, in the eyes of our culture, charge them fines or interest rates that are effectively punitive and make it that much more difficult for them to indeed reimburse the money they borrowed.
And another big area or arena of borrowing is, of course, the mortgage, home mortgages. And you spoke a little bit about that. So what should we know about kind of the history of lending to buy a home and how that's changed over time?
Well, there's a rich history to mortgages in the U.S. in particular. Other people tell it better than I. But one of the things to remember here is that workers who own a home, or rather who have a mortgage, were seen to be less likely to go on strike. So there was an effort on the part of capital, if you will, in conjunction with the U.S. government to facilitate home ownership, which is to say a form of indebtedness, such that people would have the pleasures of owning a home, but also would be less likely to go on strike, which then would make it very difficult indeed to pay their mortgage. So that's kind of, if you will, a dark side to the so-called ownership society that has since been celebrated. There are specific moments in that history as well where, you know, if you're a banker and you want to lend money, it's a pretty risky proposition to lend money to somebody who wants to buy a house because it's a long-term investment. So what the government did was try to help banks issue mortgages by buying the mortgages off the banks. And so that way the money was, I forget how they put it exactly, but the idea was to have private capital used for a public purpose. And so the challenge there was to have a secondary market for mortgages. So one of the things in the story of the government's involvement in the mortgage lending process is the creation of the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, or also known as Freddie Mac, in the 70s. And the idea there was to attract private capital for public purpose, I think, was the way it was put. And the idea was that it would serve as a kind of liaison between people who wanted to buy a home and then people who were basically banks or investors who would be willing to lend that money. So the strategy was that basically Freddie Mac would buy the mortgages and either they would hold the mortgages until they reach maturity, or they would then sell the markets on these secondary markets.
They would sell the mortgages on the secondary market.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's where these so-called mortgage-backed securities come in, where you bundle together these mortgages and you sell them as new securities.
And how is someone supposed to figure out what value a particular bundle of mortgages or pool of mortgages has?
Well, that was a very difficult challenge, right? It's difficult to assess the riskiness or the value of a mortgage until the use of the FICO score. So the FICO score is a credit score that is based on consumer credit. But basically, if you use it as a proxy for your general credit worthiness, so you can determine the riskiness of a given mortgage. Ultimately, you can use it to determine the riskiness of a pool of mortgages. So if you've lent money to person A, person B, person C, and you've used their credit score in each case to determine the interest rate, you're able also to calculate the riskiness of your own portfolio. That is to say, all these people are now paying their mortgages to you, and you can say to the world, to financial markets, listen, I have a diversified portfolio. Person A is a bit risky, but person B is very safe. And I've lent to so many people that I'm overall very safe. And I can tell you precisely how safe I am or how risky I am because of this credit score that is used as a basis for this determination.
And this relates back to what you were saying about if you as a lender can assemble a diversified portfolio of securities, then that allows you to present yourself to financial markets and say, I deserve to borrow money at favorable rates. And of course, that's going to really help your bottom line as a lender.
Exactly. And so you as the money bags character have become more credible or more probable as a result merely of a ostensibly fair exchange. When you give people the credit that corresponds to their risk level, you somehow magically appear more probable in the end.
And so one question becomes, and you take it up in a really penetrating way in this book, Portfolio Society. One question is, well, where is the exploitation in that? I mean, if this is all legal, if this is how lenders are allowed to conduct themselves, both in relation to borrowers and prospective borrowers and to financial markets that might lend the lender money, then how is this even close to the paradigmatic factory worker example pointed to so often by Marx, where you have exploitation, where you have people who are suffering, who are laboring under, you know, very serious duress because they're just trying to make money with their labor power to survive and to reproduce themselves so they can go back to work next day? So is there an analogy you see between the exploitation in the factory and the exploitation, if there is any, in the realm of finance?
Well, in a sense, I would say that the exploitation is the same as it always was. I mean, in the story that Marx tells, the workers knew very well they were being exploited. They didn't need Marx to tell them that. What Marx was able to show was that that exploitation was made to appear legitimate. And that's analogous to what we have now. I think people know very well that they're being exploited when they're being charged interest rates that they can't afford. But again, it's done under the veneer of contract law. One of the things that has changed, or a different emphasis, is that the liberal subject of the 19th century was one that was able to alienate their labor power in exchange for a wage. And if you will, the neoliberal subject is one who, on top of that, is able to alienate their promise-making ability. So it's still the same subject with property in their person, but it's also somebody who has the capacity to make promises, and that capacity is both a site of power and possible disempowering.
Ivan Asher is his name, Ascher. He teaches political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We'll take a short break and speak more with Ivan about his new book, Portfolio Society, on the capitalist mode of prediction. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ivan Asher is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're talking about a very interesting book he wrote about finance capital and the sway it holds over our lives and what it means for the power of finance and the power of capital in the neoliberal era and in the neoliberal regime that is the U.S. economy and society. At the end of the chapter we were talking about, Ivan, you bring up what a factory manager at General Motors thinks about, and it's not only about how to get more out of the workers at the factory. What is it also about?
Well, truth be told, I'm speaking here, it's a bit speculative. I don't know what the manager at General Motors is concerned with, but I can only imagine that much as in the 19th century, there would be a concern with productivity. So you want workers to produce as much as possible in as little time as possible. But there are other metrics that are also involved, having to do with assessing the risk associated with, say, lending money to somebody who might want to buy a car. So one of the amusing thing. So it's not amusing, but it's a startling figure that General Motors has gone from being a car company to a financial corporation. What used to be called the General Motors Acceptance Corporation generates most of the profit for General Motors. So it's really an institution that allows people to buy cars by lending them money as much as it is an institution that makes cars.
So, right, this used to be GMAC. We used to hear that on commercials. So, in other words, the lending part of the operation, what to lend to people who buy the cars, is more important or is more profitable than the actual making and selling of the cars.
It's more profitable, and it's also part of that exploitation you were talking about, in the sense that you can be as much affected by a change in the interest rate in your car payment than you are by your wage. So it's also a site of exploitation, or at least predation, as much as the standard wage relation.
So hovering behind what we've been talking about is, as you lay out in this book, the necessity of people to borrow, that people are desperate to obtain credit, need the loans, need the credit cards. How has that necessity arisen? Because there was a time in U.S. history when people didn't seem to need as much credit as they do now. What was the turning point or the causal factor that created this intense drive for credit, to obtain credit?
Well, again, there are different ways of telling that story. The way I tell it in the book, and it's a bit stylized, and it's again by analogy to a story that Marx tells about the so-called primitive accumulation of capital. So in the story that Marx tells, before capital came into its own, there were a few things that happened that lay the groundwork for capital. And one of them was the enclosure of the commons. And what that meant was people in England, say, had access to some extent to the commons, and it allowed them to get by. It was a struggle, but they were able to share in this together.
So this is like land where you could gather food for sustenance, that kind of thing?
Precisely. But as that land became enclosed, so people found that they had to leave the countryside and go find sustenance in the cities. So you have the rise of towns in England as a result of this. And it's a brutal story that Marx recounts in the final chapters of his book. And basically, people leave the countryside, go to the towns, and they're begging and they're vagabonds, and they're ultimately disciplined into what will later become the industrial working class. Now, this is something I mention as a backdrop to the way I see the story of comparable enclosure in the late 20th century. So as you say, there was a time, at least in the U.S., where wages were such that people weren't in the kind of conditions of precarity that they had been in the 19th century. But as wages became depressed, as certain systems had been put in place, became dismantled, the welfare state was basically undone or refashioned. The Bretton Woods system that had shielded people from fluctuating exchange rates was also undone. People found that they had to turn to financial institutions as a way of protecting themselves, when before they were able to protect each other in a kind of collective fashion. So in a sense, you can think of the welfare state in its heyday as a commons of sort, where health insurance, retirement insurance, and so forth were means of protection that were afforded to all of us, or that were held in common, but effectively become privatized. And that's one way of telling the story of the rise of finance and the increasing reliance on credit.
You write that the common element of the domestic bargain, so this is the bargain in the U.S. in the mid-20th century between capital on the one hand and labor on the other, was the mutualizing of risk. And I assume that means that, you know, labor, that workers were making a fairly good wage and getting fairly good benefits, and so the risk was not all on their side. What has happened to that mutualization of risk, and what have been the consequences of that for workers, for ordinary people?
Well, so what was, in retrospect, mutualized has become privatized, right? So one way of telling the story, and this is a phrase I borrow from Jacob Hacker, he says that employers, so basically in this bargain that you mentioned, one way of talking about it is a bargain between capital and labor. So workers would agree not to strike, And in exchange for that, they were getting a decent share of the value that they were producing. And so long as that's mutually agreeable, that's okay. Once the capitalists find that this deal is too advantageous to the worker, that they're not able to generate the profits that they were once expected to, so that deal becomes undone. And employers want, as Hacker puts it, they want out of that social contract. And they're effectively able to opt out, say, no longer providing health insurance or retirement, what we might call old age insurance, insurance against the likelihood that you might unfortunately live long. So those provisions are no longer available, and so workers have to find other ways to shield themselves from those possible risks.
And in the process, they take on further risk by borrowing money that they may not, in fact, be able to pay back, given sometimes the interest rates that are imposed on them.
That's right. So in a sense, if you think of the ad campaigns of credit card companies, they appeal, different campaigns will appeal to different sentiments. But if you think of American Express, I think it's something like, don't leave home without it. It's clearly something of a safety net, right? Your credit card is something that will protect you in case of emergency. And at the same time as it's a safety net, it's also a net in which you can really get all entangled, because once you've used that credit card once or twice, you find yourself beholden to your lender in a way that you hadn't been before.
You were talking earlier about Marx's analysis of 15th, 16th century England, for example, and the enclosure of the commons. And so literally these areas were fenced off, and so peasants no longer had access to these areas, were pushed into the city, pushed off the land, became vagabonds, were disciplined by laws created, regimes created by governments, into becoming part of this new industrial working class. They were also punished if they didn't become workers and compliant workers, if they didn't go the way of getting into these, for example, factories and contributing to the economy. So now we have, do you see a kind of vagabondage happening in the current historical moment? And if so, who are the new vagabonds and what is being done perhaps to them to discipline them or possibly punish them?
On one level, there is something quite analogous to what we saw or what Marx describes in this period of enclosures, which is actual vagabonds, people in such dire conditions that they have to resort to begging. And there is a discipline that is, if not quite as gory as the one that Marx describes, nonetheless very real. So a kind of criminalization of poverty that I think can be compared quite strictly to the one that Marx describes. But there's also a kind of disciplining that occurs that is less visible, and that's the kind of disciplining that occurs at the level of the credit relation. So if you think, for instance, by analogy again, much as the peasants had to leave the countryside and go to the towns, people who lose their health insurance, say, from their employer, have to go to the City of London. The City of London is what people call the financial district in London. So you can think of moving to the city the way people earlier had moved to towns. And when you go to the financial markets, it's ostensibly a rather inviting world. People will give you credit cards, and there's no physical violence. And yet, the terms under which you're given credit can turn into a form of violence that I think many of us are increasingly becoming aware of. So, for instance, if you default on a payment, a mortgage or your student loans, or are simply late in making a payment, so your credit score will be docked. And if your parents have, say, co-signed on that student loan that you took, their credit score is going to be docked as well. And so it's a kind of disciplining that I think that plays a similar role to the kind of disciplining that Marx describes, but it's not as visible to the eye, and it doesn't sear the skin the way that the branding of vagabonds did. And yet it's also very productive of a certain kind of subject. So the way that the branding of the vagabonds, so the stories of vagabonds who were turned into slaves or even killed if they were caught begging, I'm not saying that this is what's happening to people who are defaulting on their loans, but the kind of punishment that is at work in the form of credit scores is productive of a certain kind of subject, one who is what I call homo probabilis, somebody who can count and be counted upon. And that subject is key to the neoliberal financialized capitalism of today, just as the industrial working class was key to the capitalism that Marx described.
Ivan Asher, assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He joins me on Against the Grain to talk about his book, Portfolio Society, on the capitalist mode of prediction. I'm C.S. Song. So we've talked about like borrowers, the dilemma of the individual borrower vis-a-vis the creditor. Does anything need to be said about the degree to which borrowers are actually competing against each other, are pitted against each other by the system?
Borrowers are indeed pitted against each other in ways that they're not necessarily aware of. One of the complicating factors in talking about these things is that relations are such that all lenders are really borrowers as well. So the money banks character I described is in competition with other money lenders, and they are themselves involved in borrowing on financial markets. Some borrowers are borrowing on better terms than others, and that's also part of the competition. The remarkable ingenuity of the system is that people are pitted against each other in ways that, even if they were aware of, it would be very difficult to negotiate. So, for instance, if I'm trying to make good on my payments on my credit card, I am inadvertently putting pressure on those who are struggling to make their payments on their credit card. In other words, my behaving as a good borrower is increasing somebody else's riskiness in the eyes of the lender. And so there's a way in which, yes, there's a kind of a competition, but it doesn't meet the eye. We are asked to make good on our payments, and who doesn't want to have a good credit score? But in so doing, we're also asked to put pressure on others in a competition that is almost entirely opaque.
Is there any way, Ivan, to just opt out of the system altogether? I mean, let's say somebody doesn't need credit. Is there a way to get out of this whole regime, or is the system set up so that we are ineluctably drawn to it and have to participate in it?
Sadly, increasingly, it's difficult to opt out. I mean, if you think of any transaction you do online, you need a credit card, or you need some kind of identity that you can use online. And what that means, in effect, is that the market itself has been enclosed in the way that the commons had been enclosed before. If I'm buying something online or if I'm using my credit card, I have to produce myself as a creditworthy subject before I can engage in any kind of transaction. So as I was saying earlier, if you're using a credit card to buy a cup of coffee, you're really not buying the cup of coffee. You're borrowing money from the bank that is lending you money, that is buying the coffee in your stead. And on the other end, the merchant is also, they also have to present themselves as creditworthy borrowers in the eyes of Visa as well. So you have what was once a seemingly simple transaction that has now become enclosed itself such that some people, they can't engage in those transactions, but the rest of us who can have to be disciplined in ways that are layered on top of the kind of discipline that we had in the factory place before.
So this notion of, and really this reality of presenting oneself to society, to lenders, to businesses, to firms, to markets, is an important part of your argument, I sense, that something has changed or maybe become intensified in the way that individuals need to present themselves and take responsibility for themselves in a certain way. Could you elaborate on that?
You mentioned responsibility, and I think that is something I don't talk about much in the book, but I think is in the background of the story, which is that the neoliberal paradigm is one in which increasingly we are being responsibilized. And this is a phrase I borrow from Wendy Brown, who has a book on neoliberalism called Undoing the Demos, where this, it's not a matter of simply self-presentation, but it's a certain kind of subjectivity where indeed we have to be mindful of our creditworthiness or the way in which we are perceived as subjects worthy of investment. And you see this not simply in the strictly financial world, but also even in the world of education, where people are seeking education, say, not simply for the content of the education, but for the degrees that they are afforded by a university or given by a university, such that you have students' relation to their schooling shaped by the same rationality. And it does rely on this conceit that we are able to make promises and that we should be held accountable. And there is a notion of responsibility at work there, but it really obfuscates the ways in which the hand you have been dealt makes it that much more difficult for some to be responsible than others.
So one is tempted, Ivan, on reading this book, Portfolio Society, hearing you talk, that the notion of the portfolio, the reality of the portfolio, the credit portfolio, the asset portfolio, the investment portfolio, is hegemonic to the point that we really can't escape it, that there's no way really out of this system, which holds us in thrall, because many of us really like to get and use credit cards, for example, that imposes a kind of, as you said, and I think you said in your book actually, bloodless violence on many people who, for example, aren't that credit worthy and have had problems paying back debts and therefore are in a sense redlined by the financial industry, that this is such a powerful system, a powerful source of profits for capitalists, for lenders and investors, that we're just helpless victims in the face of it all. How do you respond to that statement? Do you even agree with it?
Helpless victims, I don't know. Helpless, perhaps. Victims, it depends. One of the difficulties, so the book is modeled after Marx's Capital, but it doesn't have the ambition of Marx. That is to say, there's sadly no programmatic statement here. There's no great hope on the horizon. What I hope to do in kind of excavating this is make us aware, or at least for me, it was almost an exercise in self-clarification, to become aware of the ways in which we are complicit or victim in a system in ways that we perhaps hadn't quite realized. Helplessness is not an option. The best I can hope for is that this kind of scrutiny would give us an awareness of what it is that we're doing when we are doing what we're doing. So if there are ways of interrupting this process or of reconfiguring it in ways that would make it less unjust or that would make it more democratic, then that's something to strive for. At the very least, I think we need to be aware of the changes in which the capitalist relations have evolved such that we don't campaign on antiquated platforms.
Ivan Asher, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We've been talking about his book, Portfolio Society, on the capitalist mode of prediction. It's published by Zone Books. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to Ivan's faculty page at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Thanks so much, Ivan, for writing this book and for talking with me about it.
Thanks so much to you.
And in the time remaining, we turn to a scholar of finance who Ivan Asher quotes approvingly in his book. Max Haven is the author of many books, including Cultures of Financialization. He is Canada Research Chair in Culture, Media, and Social Justice at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada. Here's what Max Haven told me a few years back about the impact of financial sector logic on everyday life.
I think once we begin to understand financialization in a broader scope, we can begin to see its traces all over the place. I mean, I'm a university teacher and quite involved in the politics of the university. So one of the places I see it most frequently is in the way that students, parents, governments, and university administrators increasingly have come to understand education as a quote-unquote investment. And we hear this sort of nauseating rhetoric all the time, that students shouldn't expect that governments will pay for their education, but instead that they should, you know, take out a loan and leverage that debt, that financialized debt, in order to buy a credential, a university education, which they'll then be able to go on to the job market and sell back to recoup their costs. Of course, this comes at a time when in the United States alone, student loan debt has topped $1 trillion, and when default rates and delinquency rates on student loan debt are skyrocketing. And in fact, many new reports are emerging to indicate that the weight of this student debt on younger generations is fundamentally eroding and undermining their life chances. They're putting off having families, buying homes, becoming economic members of society because of the weight of this debt. And this is, I think, symptomatic of a much deeper shift in our society. As this neoliberal ideology takes hold, we're all encouraged to see ourselves as individual competitive agents rather than any form of collectivity. We're no longer encouraged to see ourselves as citizens who care for one another, let alone something more that I would like to see, which is as commoners, as people who are fundamentally dependent on one another, who create common forms of wealth and common forms of community care. All of that's pushed aside in favor of this idea that we should all sort of see ourselves as miniature Donald Trump. And of course, Donald Trump is an excellent example of precisely how this sort of ideology enters into the mainstream and popular culture. The popular show The Apprentice, which has been on, you know, for many years and was really organized around his persona, really attempts to show us what the exalted neoliberal financialized subject looks like. One who has no compulsion about betraying one's friends and allies, one who ruthlessly competes to outperform one's peers. This is the image that's held up to all of us now. And so another example, for instance, is the incredible popularity of home renovation television, reality television shows, where the idea is you're going to go out and buy a home, not because you have a commitment to community, not because you want a roof over your head, but because you want to use it as a financial asset that you can leverage for greater gain in the future. And this idea has really seeped out and saturated throughout all of society, so that increasingly we're talking about everything as investments. There are a plethora now of relationship advice books, which advise the reader to understand themselves not as a lover or a friend or a companion, but as an investor in relationships. There's advice books that encourage parents to educate their children as savvy financial investors, to see the family as a corporation that needs to be managed as you would manage Goldman Sachs. This is extremely dangerous, and it's dangerous not only in the sense that it normalizes the neoliberal paradigm of individualistic competition, but it also valorizes really the worst elements of our human nature, in a sense, and it fundamentally privatizes our sense of the future. So if we can no longer rely on one another to provide for our futures, then it all just becomes the competitive work of the individual.
Max Haven's books include Cultures of Financialization and Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.